You know, when you picture a financial heist, I mean, your brain probably goes straight to the movies, right?
Oh, absolutely. Ski masks, getaway cars.
Yeah, or like someone hacking a mainframe in a dark room with green code falling down the screen.
Right, the classic Hollywood setup.
But right now, as you are listening to this, there is an entirely invisible shift happening in global finance. Criminals aren't really just robbing banks anymore.
No, not at all. They are using these wildly complex webs of foreign trusts, domestic shell companies, virtual asset providers, and cross-border payments.
It's a maze. It's so dense that traditional law enforcement often can't even see the walls, let alone find the exit.
Exactly. It is a totally different landscape today. I mean, the modern financial criminal doesn't need a ski mask. They just need a corporate formation agent and a high-speed internet connection.
Which is wild to think about. And that reality has fundamentally broken the way the world tries to stop dirty money.
It really has.
Which brings us to our mission for this deep dive. We've got our hands on a comprehensive analysis of global anti-money laundering, or AML, regulations.
That is a lot to digest.
It is a massive pile of sources. But the core message across all of them is loud and clear. The era of box-checking compliance is just completely dead.
Totally obsolete. I mean, the overarching theme we are seeing globally is that regulators are forcing financial institutions to make this profound shift.
From just having a policy to actually proving it works.
Right. They have to move from what we call formal compliance, which basically just means having a written policy sitting in a dusty binder somewhere, to demonstrated effectiveness.
So you can't just say, hey, we have a rule against bad actors.
Exactly. And
Okay.
now I have to prove with verifiable data that your system actually catches them in real time. A technically complete policy means absolutely nothing if your data is unreliable.
Or if you only catch the suspicious activity, like 3 months after the money is already offshore. Okay, let's unpack this. Because listening to this, it sounds like regulators are finally realizing that having a state-of-the-art lock on the front door is completely useless if the criminals are just paying the architect to build a secret tunnel out back.
That is a brilliant way to look at it, honestly. To stop financial criminals, you first have to know who actually owns the companies moving the money.
Right.
In the compliance world, this is called beneficial ownership. You have to figure out the actual human being pulling the strings behind the corporate veil.
But how you do that is changing rapidly, right? Our sources show drastically different approaches when we look at the major global players.
Oh, absolutely, night and day.
Let's start with the US, because I know they just went through a huge change here. I was reading the notes on the Corporate Transparency Act, and it seems like the strategy just did a complete 180-degree turn.
It really did. Originally, the Corporate Transparency Act was supposed to be this monumental shift for the U.S.
Right, they were going to create a giant database.
Yeah, a comprehensive federal database run by FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network.
The idea being that law enforcement and banks could just check the database.
Exactly. The goal was to strip the anonymity away from shell companies by forcing basically any entity formed or registered in the U.S. to hand over the names of the individuals who ultimately owned or controlled them.
So everyone would finally have this central hub of truth.
That was the plan. But then comes the twist, and it's a huge one.
Yeah, the March 2025 rule, what actually happened there?
FinCEN issued an interim final rule that just fundamentally altered the landscape. They exempted all entities created in the United States, along with their beneficial owners, from this federal reporting requirement.
Wait. So domestic U.S. companies don't have to report who owns them to this huge new database?
Nope. U.S. persons were entirely exempted from providing their beneficial ownership info. So now that database primarily focuses just on certain foreign entities registered to do business in the U.S.
That is what.
And critically, even those foreign entities aren't required to report beneficial ownership information if it concerns U.S. persons.
So if I am a financial institution relying on this shiny new federal database to screen my domestic U.S. clients, I'm basically looking at a phone book where half the pages have been ripped out.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
How is a bank supposed to do its customer due diligence, its CDD, if the federal database just opted out the home team?
Well, it creates a massive operational headache because the narrowing of the reporting requirement doesn't actually remove the bank's responsibility to know who they are dealing with.
Right, the banks still have the obligation.
Yes, they still have to identify and verify customers, understand the control structures, and monitor risks. Operationally, this means beneficial ownership remains a really heavy investigative process.
So they can't just run a quick search and be done with it. What does that investigative process actually look like in practice now?
To verify a domestic client today, firms essentially have to piece the puzzle together themselves.
Like private investigators.
Basically, yeah. They might cross-reference a customer's own declarations with local state and corporation records, pull corporate tax filings, scrape websites for leadership structures.
They're digging through everything.
They really have to. They analyze recent transaction activity and pull evidence from connected parent companies.
Which just proves that the intended direction of a law can be totally different from what's actually enforced.
Exactly. You can't just rely on the government to hand you the answers on a silver platter.
Well, if the U.S. is backing away from transparency like this, is anyone else stepping up to fill that void? Or is corporate anonymity just the new normal everywhere?
Well, if you look across the pond, the U.K. is taking the complete opposite approach.
Really? How so?
To tackle the exact same problem of corporate anonymity, they enacted the Economic Crime and Corporate Transparency Act of 2023. The contrast is striking, honestly.
The sources mentioned Companies House?
Yes. Companies House is their national registrar of companies. Historically, it was essentially a passive filing cabinet. You sent them your forms, they filed them away, no questions asked.
So anyone could just register whatever they wanted?
Pretty much. But that framework changed completely. They have become an active gatekeeper.
Meaning they actually check the homework now?
Big time. They now have the power to query, reject, annotate, and even remove information. If something looks suspicious, they can place a warning annotation directly on the public file.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they can take direct action against companies created for unlawful purposes.
And there was a major milestone recently, right? Like November 18th, 2025.
Spot on. That is when mandatory identity verification officially began for new directors and people with significant control.
So you have to prove you are who you say you are before you can start a company.
Exactly. And they didn't just stop at new companies. They rolled out a transition period for millions of existing directors to complete this verification too.
That is a massive undertaking.
It is. They are aggressively trying to stop people from creating companies using false identities, stolen passports, or, you know, fabricated addresses.
Which sounds great on paper, but just because you prove you are John Doe doesn't mean John Doe's consulting firm isn't actually a front for moving illicit cash.
And that is the crucial so what for anyone looking at how this impacts global finance. Verifying a person's ID does not prove that the business itself is legitimate.
Right. You could be a real person running a totally fake business.
Precisely. Just because you proved your identity doesn't mean your transactions have a lawful purpose. So, even with this incredibly active gatekeeper in the UK, financial institutions still have to prove the economic credibility of the company.
They still have to do the legwork.
Yeah, they have to assess if the ownership structure actually makes sense for the stated purpose of the business.
Okay, so knowing the human behind the company is step one. But what happens when the actual executives of a real verified company just decide to look the other way while their employees commit crimes?
Well, this is where the UK took another unprecedented step. On September 1st, 2025, a new corporate offense came into force. The failure to prevent fraud.
Failure to prevent fraud. Meaning if you don't stop it, you're guilty.
Essentially, yes. Large organizations are now criminally liable if an associated person commits a fraud offense intending to benefit the organization. And the organization lacked, quote, reasonable fraud prevention procedures.
Man, if we unpack the implications of that, it means it's no longer just the compliance team on the hook in some back office.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is arguably the most significant culture shift in modern compliance. This forces anti-money laundering out of the compliance basement and pushes it straight into the corporate boardroom.
Because the executives can actually be held criminally liable now.
Exactly. It connects financial crime directly to corporate culture. It's about third-party risk, employee conduct, and crucially, sales incentives.
Wait, how do sales incentives tie into money laundering?
Well, think about it this way. Say your executive team creates a bonus structure that rewards sales reps for closing deals as fast as possible.
Okay. Pretty standard sales environment.
Right. But then a rep ignores obvious red flags on a shady transaction just to hit their quota and benefit the company's bottom line.
I see.
The organization itself can now be held criminally liable for that. You can't just throw an entry-level compliance officer under the bus anymore and say, oh, they missed it.
The executives have to own the risk. They built the incentive structure.
Exactly.
And speaking of expanding the net, it's not just the corporations themselves being scrutinized. It's the professionals who set them up. I was reading about Australia's Tranche 2 reforms.
Yes, Australia is a fascinating case here.
Because historically, they left a lot of professions completely unregulated, right?
They did. For a long time, Australia's anti-money laundering regulations applied strictly to traditional financial institutions, gambling businesses, and remittance providers.
Basically, the obvious targets.
Right. But on July 1st, 2026, newly regulated sectors came firmly into scope. We are talking about the gatekeepers.
Which means who, exactly?
Legal professionals, accountants, conveyancers, real estate professionals, trust and company service providers, and dealers in precious metals and stones.
The people who actually hold the keys to the legitimate economy.
Precisely. These professions play legitimate, essential roles in corporate formation and wealth management. But a money launderer doesn't want to walk into a bank with a bag of cash anymore.
Oh, that's too risky.
Exactly. They want a legitimate lawyer to set up a trust that buys a commercial property. Or they want an accountant to move funds that help finance the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction.
Which is known as proliferation financing.
Right.
Okay, I have to push back here, though, because I can see a major international bank having an entire floor of people dedicated to tracking things like proliferation financing.
Sure.
But how on earth is a small town accountant or a local real estate agent supposed to run a sophisticated financial crime program?
It's a great question.
I mean, they have to enroll with AUSTRAC, appoint a compliance officer, establish a risk-based program, and report suspicious matters. That feels like an overwhelming burden for a small practice.
You've hit on the absolute biggest challenge of the Tranche 2 reforms. Implementation is incredibly difficult for smaller practices that have zero previous exposure to formal financial crime regulation.
I bet they're terrified.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And the source material is clear. A generic, out-of-the-box policy or some cheap outsourced verification tool will not cut it.
So what is the actual mechanism? What do they have to do to not go to jail?
They have to perform localized risk mapping. A real estate agent in Sydney needs to look at their specific client base, the geographic origins of the funds they typically see, and the types of properties they sell, and build controls specifically for those vulnerabilities.
So it has to be custom tailored to their actual daily business.
Yes. And it creates a fascinating ripple effect up the chain.
How so? Like, how does the small real estate agent affect the big banks?
Well, even the biggest tier one banks now have to scrutinize their reliance on these newly regulated intermediaries. The fact that a property professional is now regulated doesn't mean they immediately present a lower risk.
Because they might be terrible at it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Banks have to audit these gatekeepers. They send out detailed questionnaires to verify if the accountant actually has operational controls in place before they will process transactions originating from that accountant's office.
So we have the U.S. changing rules, the U.K. holding executives liable, and Australia regulating local accountants. How do you even enforce this globally?
It's extremely complicated.
Especially in a place like the European Union, where you have 27 different countries with their own national agendas.
Historically, the EU operated on a highly fragmented system of directives. Mm. They would issue a directive, and then each member state would interpret it and write their own national laws.
Which sounds like a nightmare for cross-border banks.
It was. You could have a bank operating across five European countries, dealing with five totally different interpretations of what constituted adequate customer due diligence.
But the EU has made a radical shift, according to the sources.
Yes. They adopted a single, directly applicable anti-money laundering regulation.
Here's where it gets really interesting. A single rule book across all member states.
No more local interpretation. The rule is the rule.
And the research mentioned some highly specific changes in this rule book.
Yes, they instituted a union-wide cash payment limit of 10,000 euros.
Wow, okay.
They also brought professional football clubs and agents into the AML perimeter.
Wait, professional football clubs? Like soccer teams?
Yeah. Given the astronomical, often opaque transfer fees in European football, they are huge vehicles for money laundering.
That actually makes a lot of sense.
But the real enforcement teeth of this package is AMLA.
AMLA, the new authority for anti-money laundering.
Correct. They began operating in Frankfurt in 2025. And this is not just an advisory board. AMLA is progressively building its supervisory capabilities, and their timeline is aggressive.
What are they actually going to do?
During 2027, AMLA will select 40 significant cross-border financial entities. By 2028, those entities fall under ANLA's direct supervision.
Direct supervision, meaning the central EU authority is looking over your shoulder, not just a friendly local regulator who might cut you a break.
Exactly.
But the sheer volume of data involved in monitoring all these different jurisdictions, different banks, football clubs. I mean, human beings alone cannot process this amount of risk data.
No, it's impossible for humans alone.
Which is why the sources mentioned banks heavily turning to AI.
They have to. Institutions are using machine learning to parse millions of transactions. Mm. They use graph analytics, which is essentially a digital version of a detective string board, you know, connecting hidden relationships between accounts, phone numbers, and IP addresses.
Like those cork boards with the red string.
Exactly. They use natural language processing, or NLP, to read and understand the context of millions of cross-border payment messages in seconds.
But relying on AI brings in a whole new layer of regulation, right? I mean, the EU AI Act.
Yes, which entered into force in August 2024, with major transparency obligations taking effect in August 2026. The regulatory question is no longer whether firms can use AI to catch money laundering.
Everyone assumes they have to use it.
Right. The question is whether they can demonstrate that the AI technology is governed, explainable, and secure.
And this is where my head spins a bit. How does a bank actually prove an algorithm isn't biased? Or what happens when an AI model suffers from model drift?
Model drift is a huge issue.
How does that actually happen in a banking context?
Okay, so say you trained an AI model on consumer behavior data from 2019. Then a global pandemic happens, and suddenly everyone's spending habits change completely.
Oh, right, because everyone is buying groceries online instead of traveling.
Exactly. The model drifts from reality, because the underlying data it was trained on no longer represents the real world. It starts flagging perfectly normal transactions as highly suspicious.
And if it's a generative AI system, it might just flat out hallucinate a reason to freeze someone's assets.
Which is a compliance nightmare.
If that happens, who is responsible?
This raises an important question, and it is the exact core of the AI governance debate. The EU AI Act isn't trying to stop innovation. The goal is traceable evidence.
Meaning what, exactly?
If an AI model flags a customer, the conclusion must remain traceable back to the source evidence. You have to prove why the model made that decision.
But how do you extract a readable explanation from a complex black box neural network?
It requires specific technical mechanisms like feature important scoring.
Okay, tell me about that. What is feature important scoring?
It's where the system highlights the exact three variables, maybe transaction size, location, and velocity, that actually triggered the alert. It gives you the why.
So it's not just computer says no.
Exactly. And crucially, the regulation mandates a human-in-the-loop approach. Material decisions require meaningful human oversight. You cannot just blindly trust the machine.
You have to have a person sign off on it.
Yes. You have to maintain inventories of your AI use cases and constantly validate their performance against actual financial crime objectives.
Okay, let's put this all together. We have shifting beneficial ownership rules, new liable professions in Australia, centralized EU supervision, and AI that we have to mathematically explain to human regulators.
It's a lot.
It is. If you were building a modern corporate governance system today, how does this actually work in practice?
Well, the source material provides a blueprint for survival called the Resilient Control Stack. But rather than just listing out the concepts, let's look at how they all converge in a real-world scenario.
I like that. Let's do an example.
Authorities want visibility, wider perimeters, organizational accountability, and governed AI all at once.
So, let's say a foreign trust, represented by a local Australian conveyancer, wants to buy commercial real estate using funds derived from a newly launched crypto asset.
Perfect scenario. In the old days, a bank might have handled that with completely siloed teams. Today, the entire control stack has to activate simultaneously.
Okay, so step one.
First, the bank system applies regulatory intelligence. The compliance team needs to know in real time if that specific Australian conveyancer is currently regulated under the new Tranche 2 laws and if the U.S. corporate transparency exemptions apply to the foreign trust.
They need to track the actual enforced laws as they change, not just read high-level summaries from last year.
Right. Second, as part of onboarding, the bank must acquire reliable ownership data.
Layer 2.
Yes. They can't just trust a static registry printout. They have to independently verify the ultimate human owner of that foreign trust and constantly refresh that data if risk events occur.
Then there's the crypto element of the transaction we mentioned.
Which triggers the third layer, enterprise risk assessment. The bank's program has to adapt dynamically. When a new technology, like a niche crypto asset, enters the transaction, the risk assessment must explicitly analyze how that alters the institution's exposure to things like proliferation financing.
Got it. And let's say the bank's AI transaction monitoring system flags the crypto transfer as highly suspicious.
That requires the fourth layer, control traceability. Under the EU AI Act, the bank must be able to demonstrate exactly which data point, which specific rule, and which algorithmic weight produced that alert.
So if the AI influenced the investigation, there must be a traceable map of its logic.
Exactly. You have to show your work.
And finally, what happens with that alert?
It goes through the fifth layer, cross-functional governance. This is the end of isolated ownership. The anti-money laundering team, the fraud prevention team, the legal department, and the technology engineers must all share the escalation protocols.
Because a fraud risk is an AML risk, is an AI risk.
Exactly. Regulatory convergence makes working in silos incredibly dangerous.
And the key takeaway tying all of those layers together is how you measure success. Success is no longer measured by the volume of alerts your AI system generates or checking a box to say a policy document is complete.
No, not at all.
Success is measured by the quality of your investigations and your actual prevention outcomes.
Spot on. Institutions that only monitor the written rule rather than understanding how all these layers interact are going to remain dangerously reactive.
So what does this all mean? It means anticipating the policy direction. And that direction is pointing universally toward radical transparency, massive organizational accountability, and most importantly, demonstrable effectiveness.
You have to prove your systems actually work in the real world to catch the criminals building those secret tunnels.
Well said.
And looking at all these moving parts together, it leaves me with one lingering question.
Oh, hit me.
We explored how the U.S. explicitly exempted its own domestic companies and citizens from ultimate beneficial ownership reporting. But simultaneously, advanced AI models are being deployed globally by centralized authorities to flag suspicious behavior based on whatever data is available.
Right.
It makes you wonder if an AI is only ever as good as the data it's fed, and major domestic U.S. loopholes exist by design, are our most advanced financial crime models being artificially blinded to the biggest players right in our own backyard?
Wow. That is a fascinating thought to end on. If the data is missing, the AI won't see the crime.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. As always, keep questioning the systems around you, and we'll see you next time.